So it's at that level? Well, there are parts of this attack that just made my jaw drop, and I've seen a fair amount in my day. That's why we spent a hell of a lot of time talking to hackers and insiders in this industry and asking them, who is capable of something really, really big? Who are the seriously big players these days? We had to be pretty smart about how we framed our questions so that nobody would guess what actually happened. For a long time, we got nowhere. It was like shooting in the dark, like calling out into the dead of night. Nobody knew anything, or they claimed they didn't. A few names were mentioned, but none of them felt right. For a while, we chased down some Russian, a Yuri Bogdanov, an ex-druggie and thief who apparently can hack into anything he damn well likes. The security companies were already trying to recruit him when he was living on the street in St. Petersburg, hot-wiring cars weighing in at 90 pounds of skin and bone. Even the people from the police and intelligence services wanted him on their side. They lost that battle, needless to say. These days Bogdanov looks clean and successful and has ballooned to 130 pounds of skin and bone, but we're pretty sure he's one of the crooks in your organization, Alona. That was another reason he interested us. There had to be a connection to the spiders because of the searches that got carried out. But then, you couldn't understand why one of their own would be giving us new leads and associations? Exactly, and so we looked further. After a while, another outfit cropped up in the conversations. Which one? They call themselves Hacker Republic. They have a big reputation out there. A bunch of talents at the top of their game and rigorous about their encryptions, and for good reason. We're constantly trying to infiltrate these groups, and we're not the only ones. We don't just want to find out what they're up to. We also want to recruit people. These days there's big competition for the sharpest hackers. Now that we've all become criminals. Ha! Yes, maybe. Whatever. Hacker Republic has major talent. Lots of the guys we talked to backed that up. And it wasn't just that. There were also rumors that they had something big going on. And then a hacker with the handle Bob the Dog, who we think is linked to the gang, was running searches and asking questions about one of our guys, Richard Fuller. Do you know him? No. A manic, depressive, self-righteous prick who's been bugging me for a while. The archetypal security risk who gets arrogant and sloppy when he's in a manic phase. He's just the kind of person a bunch of hackers should be targeting, and you need classified information to know that. His mental health issues aren't exactly common knowledge. His own mother hardly knows. But I'm pretty confident that in the end they didn't get in via Fuller. We've examined every file he's received recently and there's nothing there. We've scrutinized him from top to bottom. But I bet Fuller was part of Hacker Republic's original plan, and then they changed strategies. I can't claim to have any hard evidence against them, not at all, but my gut feeling is that these guys are behind the break-in.
You said the hacker was a girl.
Right. Once we'd homed in on this group, we found out as much as possible about them. It wasn't easy to separate rumor from myth and from fact, but one thing came up so often that in the end I saw no reason to question it.
And what's that?
Hacker Republic's big star is someone who uses the alias Wasp.
Wasp?
I won't bore you with the technical details, but Wasp is something of a legend in certain circles. One of the reasons being her ability to turn accepted methods on their heads. Someone said you can sense Wasp's involvement in a hacker attack the same way you can recognize Mozart in a melodic loop. Wasp has her own, unmistakable style, and that was the first thing one of my guys said after he'd studied the breach. This is different from anything we've come across. It's got a completely new threshold of originality.
A genius, in short.
Without a doubt. So we started to search everything we could find about this Wasp, to try to crack the handle. No one was particularly surprised when that didn't work. This person wouldn't leave openings. But you know what I did then? Needham said proudly.
Tell me.
I looked up what the word stood for.
Beyond its literal meaning, you mean?
Right. But not because I or anyone else thought it would get us anywhere. Like I said, if you can't get there on the main road, you take the side roads. You never know what you might find. It turns out Wasp could mean all sorts of things. Wasp is a British fighter plane from World War II, a comedy by Aristophanes, a famous short film from 1915, a satirical magazine from 19th century San Francisco, and is also, of course, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, plus a whole lot more. But those references are all a little too sophisticated for a hacker genius. They don't go with the culture. You know what did fit? The superhero in Marvel Comics. Wasp is one of the founding members of the Avengers.
Like the movie?
Exactly. with Thor, Iron Man, Captain America. In the original comics, she was even their leader for a while. I have to say, Wasp is a pretty badass superhero. Kind of rock and roll, a rebel who wears black and yellow with insect's wings and short black hair. She's got attitude, the underdog who hits back and can grow or shrink. All the sources we've been talking to think that's the Wasp we're looking for. It doesn't necessarily mean the person behind the handle is some Marvel Comics geek. That handle has been around for a while, so maybe it's a childhood thing that stuck, or an attempt at irony. Like the fact that I named my cat Peter Pan, even though I never liked that self-righteous asshole who doesn't want to grow up. Anyway.
Yes?
I couldn't help noticing that this criminal network Wasp was looking into also uses names from Marvel Comics. They sometimes call themselves the Spider Society, right?
Yes, but I think that's just a game as I see it, sticking it to those of us who monitor them.
Sure, I get that, but even jokes can give you leads or cover up something serious. Do you know what the Spider Society in Marvel Comics does?
No.
They wage war against the Sisterhood of the Wasp.
Okay, fine. It's an interesting detail, but I don't understand how that could be your lead.
Just wait. Will you come downstairs with me? I have to head to the airport soon.
It was not late, but Blomqvist knew that he could not keep going much longer. He had to go home and get a few hours' sleep, and then start working again tonight or tomorrow morning. It might help, too, if he had a few beers on the way. The lack of sleep was pounding in his forehead, and he needed to chase away a few memories and fears. Perhaps he could get Xander to join him. He looked over at his colleague. Xander had youth and energy to spare. He was banging away at his keyboard as if he had just started work for the day, and every now and then he flicked excitedly through his notes. Yet he had been in the office since 5 o'clock in the morning. It was now 5:45 in the evening, and he had hardly taken a break.
"What do you say, Andre? How about we get a beer and a bite to eat and discuss the story?"
At first, Xander did not seem to understand. Then he raised his head and suddenly no longer looked quite so energetic. He gave a little grimace as he massaged his shoulder.
Well, maybe,
he said hesitantly.
"I'll take that as a yes," said Blomqvist.
"How about Volksoperen?"
Volksoperen was a bar and restaurant on Hornsgarten, not far away, which attracted journalists and the arty crowd.
"It's just that," Xander said.
"Just that what?"
"I've got this portrait to do of an art dealer working at Bukowski's, who got onto a train at Malmö Central and was never seen again. Erica thought it would fit into the mix."
"Jesus, the things she makes you do, that woman."
"I honestly don't mind, but I'm having trouble pulling it together. It feels so messy and contrived."
"Do you want me to have a look at it?"
"I'd love that, but let me do some more work on it first. I would die of embarrassment if you saw it in its present state."
"In that case, deal with it later. But come on now, Andre, let's go and at least get something to eat. You can come back and work afterwards if you must," Blomqvist said. He looked over at Xander.
That memory would stay with him for a long time. Xander was wearing a brown-checked jacket and a white shirt buttoned up all the way. He looked like a film star, at any rate even more like a young Antonio Banderas than usual.
"I think I'd better stay and keep plugging away," he said. "I have something in the fridge which I can microwave."
Blomqvist wondered if he should pull rank, order him to come out and have a beer. Instead, he said,
"Okay, we'll see each other in the morning. How are they doing out there meanwhile? No drawing of the murderer yet?"
"Seems not.
We'll have to find another solution tomorrow." "Take care," Blomqvist said, getting up and putting on his overcoat.
Salander remembered something she had read about savants a long time ago in Science magazine. It was an article by Enrico Bombieri, an expert in number theory, referring to an episode in Oliver Sacks's The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, in which a pair of autistic and mentally disabled twins recite staggeringly high prime numbers to each other, as if they could see them before their eyes in some sort of inner mathematical landscape. What these twins were able to do and what Salander now wanted to achieve were two different things, but there was still a similarity, she thought, and decided to try, however skeptical she might be. So she brought up the encrypted NSA file and her program for elliptic curve factorization. Then she turned to August. He responded by rocking back and forth.
"Prime numbers. You like prime numbers," she said.
August did not look at her or stop his rocking.
"I like them too.
And there's one thing I'm particularly interested in just now. It's called factorization. Do you know what that is?
August stared at the table as he continued rocking and did not look as if he understood anything at all.
Prime number factorization is when we rewrite a number as the product of prime numbers. By product in this context, I mean the result of a multiplication. Do you follow me?
August's expression did not change, and Salander wondered if she should just shut up.
According to the fundamental principles of arithmetic, every whole number has a unique prime number factorization. It's pretty cool. We can produce a number as simple as 24 in all sorts of ways. For example, by multiplying 12 by 2, or 3 by 8, or 4 by 6. Yet there's only one way to factorize it with prime numbers, and that's 2 times 2 times 2 times 3. Are you with me? The problem is, even though it's easy to multiply prime numbers to produce large numbers, it's often impossible to go the other way, from the answer back to the prime numbers. A really bad person has used this to code a secret message. Do you understand? It's a bit like mixing a drink. Easy to do, but harder to unmix again.
August neither nodded nor said a word, but at least his body was no longer rocking.
Shall we see if you're any good at prime number factorization, August? Shall we?
August did not budge.
I'll take that as a yes. Let's start with a number 456.
August's eyes were bright but distant, and Salander had the feeling that this idea of hers really was absurd. It was cold and windy, and there were few people out, but Blomqvist thought the cold was doing him good. He was perking up a bit. He thought of his daughter Pernilla, and what she said about writing for real, and of Salander, of course, and the boy. What were they doing right now? On the way up towards Hornsgatsbokken, he stared for a while at a painting hanging in a gallery window which showed cheerful, carefree people at a cocktail party. At that moment it felt, perhaps wrongly, as if it had been ages since he had last stood like that, drink in hand and without a care in the world. Briefly he longed to be somewhere far away. Then he shivered, struck by the feeling that he was being followed. Perhaps it was a consequence of everything he had been through in the last few days. He turned round, but the only person near him was an enchantingly beautiful woman in a bright red coat with flowing dark blonde hair. She smiled at him a little uncertainly. He gave her a tentative smile back and was about to continue on his way, yet his gaze lingered, as if he were expecting the woman to turn into something more run-of-the-mill at any moment. Instead she became more dazzling with each passing second, almost like royalty, a star who had accidentally wandered in among ordinary people, a gorgeous spread in a fashion magazine. The fact was that right then, in that first moment of astonishment, Blomqvist would not have been able to describe her, or provide even one single detail about her appearance.
"Can I help you?" he said.
No,
she said, apparently shy. And there was no getting away from it. Her hesitancy was beguiling. She was not a woman you would have thought to be shy. She looked as if she might own the world.
"Well, then, have a nice evening," he said, and turned again.
But he heard her nervously clear her throat.
"Aren't you Mikael Blomqvist?" she said, even more uncertain now, looking down at the cobbles in the street.
"Yes, I am," he said, and smiled politely, as he would have done for anybody.
"Well, I just want to say that I've always admired you," she said,
raising her head and gazing into his eyes with a long look.
"I'm flattered, but it's been a long time since I wrote anything decent. Who are you?"
"My name is Rebecca Mattson," she said. "I've been living in Switzerland."
"And now you're home for a visit?"
"Only for a short time, unfortunately. I miss Sweden. I even miss November in Stockholm. But I guess that's how it is when you're homesick, isn't it?"
"What do you mean?"
"That you miss even the bad bits."
"True."
"Do you know how I cure it all? I follow the Swedish press. I don't think I've missed a single issue of Millennium in the last few years," she said.
He looked at her again, and noticed that every piece of clothing, from the black high-heeled shoes to the checked blue cashmere shawl, was expensive and elegant. Rebecca Mattson did not look like your typical Millennium reader, but there was no reason to be prejudiced, even against rich expatriate Swedes.
"Do you work there?" he said.
"I'm a widow."
"I see.
Sometimes I get so bored. Were you going somewhere?
I was thinking of having a drink and a bite to eat, he said, at once regretting his reply. It was too inviting, too predictable. But it was at least true.
May I keep you company? She asked.
That would be nice, he said, sounding unsure. Then she touched his hand. Unintentionally, at least that is what he wanted to believe. She still seemed bashful. They walked slowly up Hornsgatspokeln, past a row of galleries.
How nice to be strolling here with you, she said.
It's a bit unexpected.
So true. It's not what I was thinking when I woke up this morning.
What were you thinking?
That the day would be as dreary as ever.
I don't know if I'll be such good company, he said. I'm pretty much immersed in a story.
Are you working too hard?
Maybe so.
Then you need a little break, she said,
giving him a bewitching smile, filled with longing or some sort of promise. At that moment he thought she seemed familiar, as if he had seen that smile before, but in another form, distorted somehow. Have we met before? He said.
I don't think so, except that I've seen you 1,000 times in pictures and on TV.
So you've never lived in Stockholm?
When I was a little girl.
Where did you live then?
She pointed vaguely up Hornsgatan. Those were good times, she said. Our father took care of us. I often think about him. I miss him.
Is he no longer alive?
He died much too young.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Where are we headed?
Well, he said, there's a pub just up Bellmansgatan, the Bishop's Arms. I know the owner. It's quite a nice place.
I'm sure...
Once again she had that diffident, shy look on her face, and once again her hand happened to brush against his fingers. This time he wasn't so sure it was accidental. Perhaps it isn't fancy enough?
Oh, I'm sure it's fine, she said apologetically. It's just that people tend to stare at me. I've come across so many bastards in pubs.
I can believe it.
Wouldn't you...
What? She looked down at the ground again and blushed. At first he thought he was seeing things. Surely adults don't blush that way. But Rebecca Mattsson from Switzerland, who looked like $7 million, went red like a little schoolgirl.
"Wouldn't you like to invite me to your place instead, for a glass of wine or two?" she said. "That would be nicer."
"Well," he hesitated. He badly needed some sleep to be in good shape tomorrow. Yet he said, "Of course, I've got a bottle of Barolo in the wine rack." And for a second he thought something exciting might be about to happen after all, as if he were about to embark on an adventure. But his doubt would not subside. At first he could not understand why. He did not normally have a problem with this kind of situation. He had more success than most when it came to women flirting with him. This particular encounter had developed very quickly, but he was not unused to that either. So it was something about the woman herself, wasn't it? Not only was she young and exceptionally beautiful, and should have had better things to do than chase after burned-out middle-aged journalists, it was something in her expression, the way she switched between bold and shy, and the physical contact. Everything he had at first found spontaneous increasingly seemed to him to be contrived.
"How lovely. I won't stay long. I don't want to spoil your story," she said.
"I'll take full responsibility for any spoiled stories," he said, and tried to smile back. It was a forced smile, and in that instant he caught a strange twitch in her eyes, a sudden icy chill which in a second turned into its very opposite, full of affection and warmth, like an acting exercise. He became more convinced that there was something wrong, but he had no idea what, and did not want his suspicions to show, at least not yet. What was going on? He wanted to understand. They continued on up Bellmansgatan. He was not thinking of taking her back to his place any longer, but he needed time to figure her out. He looked at her again. She really was gorgeous. Yet it occurred to him that it was not her beauty which had first captivated him. It was something else, something more elusive. Just then he saw Rebecca Mattsson as a riddle to which he ought to have the answer.
"A nice part of town, this," she said.
"It's not bad." He looked up towards the Bishop's Arms. Diagonally across from the pub, just a bit higher up by the intersection with Tavastgatan, A scrawny, lanky man in a black cap was standing studying a map. He looked like a tourist. He had a brown suitcase in his other hand and white sneakers and a black leather jacket with its fur collar turned up, and under normal circumstances Blomquist would not have given him a second glance. But now he observed that the man's movements were nervous and unnatural. Perhaps Blomquist was suspicious to begin with, but the distracted way he was handling the map seemed more and more put on. Now he raised his head and stared straight at Blomquist and the woman, studying them for a brief second. Then he looked down at his map again, seeming ill at ease, almost trying to hide his face under the cap. The bowed, almost timid head reminded Blomquist of something, and again he looked into his companion's dark eyes. His look was persistent and intense. She gazed at him with affection, but he did not reciprocate. Instead, he scrutinized her. Then her expression froze. Only in that moment did Blomquist smile back at her. He smiled, because suddenly the penny had dropped. Chapter 22. November 23rd. Evening. Salander got up from the table. She did not want to pester August any longer. The boy was under enough pressure as it was, and her idea had been crazy from the start. One always expects too much of these poor savants, and what August had done was already impressive. She went out onto the terrace again and gingerly felt the area around the bullet wound, which was still aching. She heard a sound behind her, a hasty scratching on paper, so she turned and went back inside. When she saw what August had written, she smiled. 2 to the power of 3 × 3 × 19. She sat down and said, without looking at him this time, "Okay, I'm impressed. But let's make this a little harder. Have a go at 18,206,927. August was hunched over the table, and Salander thought it might have been unkind to throw an 8-digit figure at him right away. But if they were to stand any chance of getting what she needed, they would need to go much higher than that. She was not surprised to see August begin to sway nervously back and forth. After a few seconds he leaned forward and wrote on his paper, 9,419 × 1,933. Good. How about 971,230,541? August wrote 983 × 991 × 997. That's great, Salander said, and on they went. Outside the black, cube-like office building in Fort Meade with its reflective glass walls, not far from the big radome with its dish aerials, Casales and Needham were standing in the packed parking lot. Needham was twirling his car keys and looking beyond the electric fence in the direction of the surrounding woods. He should be on his way to the airport, he said. He was late already, but Casales did not want to let him leave. She had her hand on his shoulder and was shaking her head. That's twisted.
It's out there, he said.
So every one of the handles we've picked up for the people in the Spider Society, Thanos, Enchantress, Zemo, Alkima, Cyclone, and the rest, what they have in common is that they're all
enemies of Wasp in the original comic book series, yes.
That's insane.
A psychologist would have fun with it.
This kind of fixation must run deep.
I get the feeling it's real hate, he said.
You will be careful over there, won't you?
Don't forget I used to be in a gang.
That was a long time ago, Ed, and many pounds, too.
It's not a question of weight. What is it they say? You can take the boy out of the ghetto.
Yes, yes.
You can never get rid of it. Besides, I'll have help from the NDRE in Stockholm. They're itching as much as I am to put that hacker out of action once and for all.
What if Ingram finds out?
That wouldn't be good. But, as you can imagine, I've been laying the groundwork. Even exchanged a word or two with O'Connor.
I figured as much. Is there anything I can do for you?
Yeah.
Shoot.
Ingram's crew seems to have had full insight into the Swedish police investigation.
They've been eavesdropping on the police?
Either that, or they have a source. Maybe an ambitious soul at Seppo. If I put you together with two of my best hackers, you could do some digging.
Sounds risky.
Okay, forget it.
That wasn't a no.
Thanks, Alona. I'll send info.
Have a good trip, she said, and Needham smiled defiantly and got into his car. Looking back, Blomquist could not explain how he had worked it out. It may have been something in the Matson woman's expression, something unknown and yet familiar. The perfect harmony of that face may have reminded him of its opposite, and that, together with other hunches and misgivings, gave him the answer. True, he was not yet certain, but he had no doubt that something was very wrong. The man now walking off with his map and brown suitcase was the same figure he had seen on the security camera in Saltschulbaden, and that coincidence was too improbable not to be of some significance, so Blomquist stood there for a few seconds and thought. Then he turned to the woman who called herself Rebecca Matson and tried to sound confident.
"Your friend is heading off."
"My friend?" she said, genuinely surprised. "What friend?"
"Him up there," he said, pointing at the man's skeletal back as he sauntered gawkily down Tavastgatan.
"Are you joking? I don't know anyone in Stockholm."
"What do you want from me?"
"I just want to get to know you, Mikael," she said, fingering her blouse, as if she might undo a button.
"Stop that,"
he said sharply, and was about to lose his temper when she looked at him with such vulnerable, piteous eyes that he was thrown. For a moment he thought he had made a mistake.
"Are you cross with me?" she said, hurt.
"No, but—"
"What?"
"I don't trust you," he said, more bluntly than he intended.
She smiled sadly and said, "I can't help feeling that you're not quite yourself today, are you, Mikael? We'll have to meet some other time instead." She moved to kiss his cheek so discreetly and quickly that he had no time to stop her. She gave a flirtatious wave of her fingers and walked away up the hill on high heels, so resolutely self-assured that he wondered if he should stop her and fire some probing questions. But he could not imagine that anything would come of it. Instead, he decided to follow her. It was crazy, but he saw no alternative, so he let her disappear over the brow of the hill and then set off in pursuit. He hurried up to the intersection, sure that she could not have gone far, but there was no sign of her, or of the man either. It was as if the city had swallowed them up. The street was empty apart from a black BMW backing into a parking space some way down the block, and a man with a goatee wearing an old-fashioned Afghan coat who came walking in his direction on the opposite sidewalk. Where had they gone? There were no side streets for them to slip into, no alleys. Had they ducked into a doorway? He walked on down towards Torkel Knutsensgaten, looking left and right. Nothing. He passed what had been Samir's cauldron, once a favourite locale of his and Beria's. Now called Tabuli, it served Lebanese food. They might have stepped inside. But he could not see how she would have had time to get there. He had been hot on her heels. Where the hell was she? Was she and the man standing somewhere nearby, watching him? Twice he spun around, certain that they were right behind him, and once he gave a start because of an icy feeling that someone was looking at him through a telescopic sight. When eventually he gave up and wandered home, it felt as though he had escaped a great danger. He had no idea how close to the truth that feeling was, yet his heart was beating fiercely, and his throat was dry. He was not easily scared, but tonight he had been frightened by an empty street. The only thing he did understand was who he needed to speak to. He had to get hold of Holger Palmgren, Salander's old guardian. But first he would do his civic duty. If the man he had seen was the person from Balder's security camera, and there was even a minimal chance that he could be found, the police had to be informed. So he rang Boblansky. It was by no means easy to convince the chief inspector. It had not been easy to convince himself. But he still had some residual credibility to fall back on, however many liberties he had taken with the truth of late. Boblansky said that he would send out a unit.
"Why would he be in your part of town?" "I have no idea, but it wouldn't hurt to see if you could find him, would it?" "I suppose not." "The best of luck to you in that case." "It's damn unsatisfactory that the Balder boy is still out there somewhere," Boblansky said reproachfully. "And it's damn unsatisfactory that there was a leak in your unit," Blomquist said. "I can tell you, we've identified our leak."
"You have?
That's fantastic."
"It's not all that fantastic, I'm afraid. We believe there may have been several leaks, most of which did minimal damage except maybe for the last."
"Then you'll have to make sure you put a stop to it."
"We're doing everything we can.
but we're beginning to suspect. And then he paused.
What?
Nothing.
Okay, you don't have to tell me.
We live in a sick world, Mikkel.
We do.
A world in which paranoia is a requirement.
You could be right about that.
Good night, Chief Inspector.
Good night, Mikkel.
Don't do anything silly now.
I'll do my best.
Blomqvist crossed over Ringvägen and went down into the Tunnelbana. He took the red line towards Norsbury and got off at Liljeholmen, where for about a year Holger Palmgren had been living in a small, modern apartment. Palmgren had sounded alarmed when he heard Blomqvist's voice on the telephone, but as soon as he had been assured that Salander was in one piece, Blomqvist hoped he wasn't wrong about this, he made him feel welcome. Palmgren was a lawyer, long retired, who'd been Salander's guardian for many years, ever since the girl was 13 and had been locked up in St. Stefan's psychiatric clinic in Uppsala. He was elderly and not in the best of health, having suffered two strokes. For some time now he had been using a walker and had trouble getting around even so. The left side of his face drooped, and his left hand no longer functioned. But his mind was clear and his long-term memory was outstanding, especially on Salander. No one knew Lisbeth Salander as he did. Palmgren had succeeded where all the psychiatrists and psychologists had failed, or perhaps had not wanted to succeed. After a childhood from hell, when the girl had lost faith in all adults and in all authority, Palmgren had won her confidence and persuaded her to open up. Blomqvist saw it as a minor miracle. Salander was every therapist's nightmare, but she had told Palmgren about the most painful parts of her past. That was why Blomqvist now keyed in the front door code at Liljeholmstorje 96, took the lift to the fifth floor, and rang the doorbell.
"My dear old friend," Holger said in the doorway, "it's so wonderful to see you. But you're looking pale."
"I haven't been sleeping well."
"Not surprising when people are shooting at you. I read about it in the paper. A dreadful story."
"Appalling."
"Have there been any developments?"
"I'll tell you all about it," Blomqvist said, sitting on a yellow sofa near the balcony, waiting for Palmgren to settle with difficulty into a wheelchair next to him.
Blomqvist ran through the story in broad outline. When he came to the point of his sudden inspiration or suspicion on the cobblestones in Bellmansgarten, he was interrupted.
"What are you saying?"
"I think it was Camilla." Palmgren looked stunned.
"That Camilla?"
"The very same."
"Jesus," Palmgren said. "What happened?"
"She vanished. But afterwards I felt as if my brain were on fire."
"I can well understand. I was sure Camilla had disappeared off the face of the earth."
"And I had almost forgotten that there were two of them."
"There were two of them, all right. Very much so. Twin sisters who loathed each other."
"I remember that," Blomqvist said. "But I need to be reminded of as much as you can tell me, to fill in the gaps. I've been asking myself why on earth Salander got involved in this story. Why would she, the super-hacker, take an interest in a simple data breach?"
"Well, you know the background, don't you? The mother, Agneta Salander, was a cashier at Consum Zinken and lived with her two daughters on Lundegarten. They might have had quite a nice life together. There wasn't much money, and Agneta was very young and had had no opportunity to get an education, but she was loving and caring. She wanted to give her girls a good upbringing. It was just..."
"That the father came to visit."
"Yes, the father. Alexander Zalachenko. He came from time to time, and his visits nearly always ended in the same way. He assaulted and raped Agneta, while the girl sat in the next room and heard everything. One day Elizabeth found her mother, unconscious on the floor."
"And that was the first time she took revenge?"
"The second time. The first was when she stabbed Zalachenko repeatedly in the shoulder."
"But now she firebombed his car."
"Yes, Zalachenko burned like a torch. Elizabeth was committed to St. Stefan's psychiatric clinic."
"And her mother was admitted to Eppelviken nursing home."
"For Elizabeth that was the most painful part. Her mother was just 29, and she was never herself again. She survived at the nursing home for 14 years with severe brain injuries and suffering a great deal of pain. Often she could not communicate at all. Elizabeth went to see her as frequently as she could, and I know she dreamed that her mother would one day recover.
so they could talk again and look after each other, but it never happened.
That, if anything, is the darkest corner of Lisbeth's life. She saw her mother wither away and eventually die.
It's terrible. But I've never understood Camilla's role in the story.
That's more complicated, and in some ways I think one has to forgive the girl. After all, she too was only a child, and before she was even aware of it, she became a pawn in the game.
In what way?
They chose opposite camps in the battle, you could say. It's true that the girls are fraternal twins and not alike in appearance, but they also have completely different temperaments. Lisbeth was born first. Camilla came 20 minutes later and was apparently a joy to behold, even when she was tiny. While Lisbeth was an angry creature, Camilla had everyone exclaiming, "Oh, what a sweet girl!" And it can't have been a coincidence that Zalachenko showed more forbearance towards her from the start. I say forbearance because it was never a question of anything kinder in those first years. Since Agneta was no more than a whore to him, it followed that her children were bastards with no claim on his affections, little wretches who just got in the way. And yet?
Yes.
And yet even Zalachenko noticed that one of the children was beautiful. Sometimes Lisbeth would say there was a genetic defect in her family, and though it's doubtful that her claim would stand up to medical scrutiny, it cannot be denied that Zala fathered some exceptional children. You came across their half-brother, Ronald Niedermann, didn't you? He was blonde, enormous, and had congenital analgesia, the inability to feel pain, so was therefore an ideal hitman and murderer, while Camilla, well, in her case, the genetic abnormality was quite simply that she was astoundingly, ridiculously lovely to look at, and that just got worse as she grew older. I say worse because I'm pretty sure it was a misfortune. The effect may have been exaggerated by the fact that her twin sister always looked sour. Grown-ups were liable to frown when they saw her, but then they would notice Camilla and go soft in the head. Can you imagine how that must have impacted her?
It must have been hard to get passed over.
I wasn't thinking of Lisbeth, and I don't remember seeing any evidence that she resented the situation. If it was just a question of beauty, she probably would have felt her sister was welcome to it. No, I'm talking about Camilla. What must it do to a child who doesn't have much in the way of empathy to be told all the time how divine she is?
It goes to her head.
It gives her a sense of power. When she smiles, we melt. When she doesn't, we feel excluded and do absolutely anything to see her beam again. Camilla learned early on to exploit that. She became a master manipulator. She had large, expressive doe eyes.
She still does.
Elizabeth told me how Camilla would sit for hours in front of the mirror, practicing her look. Her eyes were a fantastic weapon. They could both bewitch you and freeze you out, make children and adults alike feel special one day and rejected the next. It was an evil gift, and, as you could guess, she soon became very popular at school. Everyone wanted to be with her, and she took advantage in every conceivable way. She made sure that her classmates gave her presents daily, marbles, sweets, small change, pearls, brooches, and those who didn't, or generally didn't behave as she wanted, she wouldn't even look at the next day. Anyone who had ever found themselves basking in her radiance knew how painful that was. Her classmates did everything they could to be in her good graces. They fawned over her, with one exception, of course.
Her sister.
That's right. And so Camilla turned them against Lisbeth. She got some fierce bullying going. They pushed Lisbeth's head into the toilet, and called her a freak and a weirdo and all sorts of names. This went on until one day they found out who they were picking on. But that's another story, and one you're familiar with.
Lisbeth doesn't turn the other cheek.
No, indeed. But the interesting thing in this story from a psychological point of view is that Camilla learned how to dominate her surroundings from an early age. She worked out how to control everybody apart from two significant people in her life, Lisbeth and her father, and that annoyed her. She put a vast amount of energy into winning those fights as well, and she needed totally different strategies for each of them. She could never win Lisbeth over, and pretty soon I think she gave up. In her eyes, Lisbeth was simply strange, a surly, stroppy girl. Her father, on the other hand,
he was evil through and through.
He was evil, but he was also the family's centre of gravity. He was the one around whom everything revolved, even if he was rarely there. He was the absent father. In a normal family, such a figure can take on a quasi-mythical status for a child.
but in this case it was much more than that.
In what way?
I suppose I mean that Camilla and Zalotchenko were an unfortunate combination. Although Camilla hardly understood it herself, she was only interested in one thing, even then, power. And her father, well, you can say many things about him, but he was not short of power. Plenty of people can testify to that, not least that wretched lot at Seppo. No matter how firmly they tried to put their foot down, they still ended up huddled like a flock of frightened sheep when they came eyeball to eyeball with him. There was an ugly, imposing self-assurance about Zalotchenko which was merely amplified by the fact that he was untouchable. It made no difference how many times he was reported to the Social Welfare Agency. The security police always protected him. This is what persuaded Lisbeth to take matters into her own hands. But for Camilla, things were different.
She wanted to be like him.
Yes, I think so. Her father was her ideal. She wanted the same aura of immunity and strength. But most of all, perhaps, she wanted to be acknowledged by him, to be seen as a worthy daughter.
She must have known how terribly he mistreated her mother.
Of course she knew. Yet still she took her father's side. One could say she chose to side with strength and power. Apparently, even as a little girl, she often said that she despised weak people.
She despised her mother, do you think?
Unfortunately, I think you're right. Elizabeth once told me something which I've never been able to forget.
What's that?
I've never told anyone.
Isn't it about time, then?
Well, maybe. But in that case, I need a strong drink. How about a good brandy?
That wouldn't be such a bad idea, but you stay right where you are. I'll get some glasses and the bottle, Lundqvist said, going to the mahogany drinks cabinet in the corner by the kitchen door. He was digging around among the bottles when his iPhone rang. It was Xander, or at least his name was on the display. But when Blomqvist answered, no one was there. It must have been a pocket call, he thought. He poured out two glasses of Remy Martin and sat down again next to Palmgren. So tell me, he said.
I don't know where to begin. But one fine summer's day, as I understood it, Camilla and Lisbeth were both sitting in their bedroom. The door was locked.
Chapter 23 November 23rd, evening. August's body stiffened again. He could no longer find the answers. The numbers were too big. Instead of picking up his pencil, he clenched his fists so that the backs of his hands whitened. He banged his head against the tabletop. Salander should have tried to comfort him, or at least prevent him from hurting himself, but she was not entirely conscious of what was happening. Her mind was on her encrypted file. She realized she was not going to get any further by this route either. It was hardly surprising. How could August succeed where supercomputers had failed? Her expectations had been absurdly high from the start. But still she felt disappointed. She went out into the darkness to survey the barren, untamed landscape before her. Below the steep rock slope lay the beach, and a snow-covered field with a deserted dance pavilion. The place probably teemed with people on a lovely summer's day. Now it was empty. The boats had been pulled up on land, and not a soul could be seen. No lights were shining in the houses on the other side of the water. Salander liked it. At least she liked it as a hiding place at the end of November. If someone arrived by car, she was unlikely to pick up the sound of the engine. The only conceivable place to park was down by the beach, and to get to the house you had to climb up the wooden stairs along the steep rock slope. Under the cover of darkness, someone might be able to sneak up on them. But she would sleep tonight. She needed it. Her wound was still giving her pain. Maybe that was why she had gotten her hopes up about August against the odds. But when she went back into the house, she realized that there was something else besides.
Normally, Lisbeth isn't someone who bothers about the weather or what's going on beyond her immediate focus, Palmgren said. She blocks out everything she considers unimportant. But on this occasion, she did mention that the sun was shining on Lundegarten and in Sunnerviksparken. She could hear children laughing. On the other side of the window pane, people were happy. Perhaps that is what she was trying to say. She wanted to point out the contrast. Ordinary people were having ice cream and playing with kites and balls. Camilla and Lisbeth
sat locked in their bedroom and could hear their father assaulting their mother. I believe this was just before Lisbeth took her revenge on Zalachenko, but I'm not sure about the sequence of events. There were many rapes, and they followed the same pattern. Zala would appear in the afternoon or evening, very drunk. Sometimes he would ruffle Camilla's hair and say things like, "How can such a pretty girl have such a loathsome sister?" Then he would lock his daughters in their room and settle down in the kitchen to have more to drink. He drank his vodka neat, and often he would sit quietly at first, smacking his lips like a hungry animal. Then he would mumble something like, "And how's my little whore today?" sounding almost affectionate. But Agneta would do something wrong, or rather, Zalachenko would decide that she had done something wrong, and then the first blow came, usually a slap, followed by, "I thought my little whore was going to behave herself today." Then he would shove her into the bedroom and beat her. After a while, slaps would turn to punches. Lisbeth could tell from the sounds. She could tell exactly what sort of blows they were and where they landed. She felt it as clearly as if she herself were the victim of this savagery. After the punches came the kicks. Zala kicked and shoved her mother against the wall and shouted, "Bitch!" and "Tramp!" and "Whore!" and that aroused him. He was turned on by her suffering. Only once Agneta was black and blue and bleeding did he rape her, and when he climaxed he would yell even fouler insults. Then it would be quiet for a while. All that could be heard was Agneta's choked sobbing and Zala's own heavy breathing. Then he would get up and have another drink and mutter and swear and spit on the floor. Sometimes he unlocked the door to the children's room with something like, "Mummy's behaving herself again now," and he would leave, slamming the door behind him. That was the usual pattern. But on this particular day, something new happened.
What?
The girls' bedroom was quite small. However hard they tried to get away from each other, the beds were still close, and while the abuse went on, each one sat on her own mattress, facing the other. They hardly ever said anything, and usually avoided eye contact. On this day, Lisbeth was staring through the window at Lundegarten. That's probably why she talked about the sunlight and the children out there. But then she looked at her sister, and that's when she saw it.
She saw what?
Camilla's right hand, beating against her mattress. It could have been a sign of nervous or compulsive behaviour. That's what Lisbeth thought at first, but then she noticed that the hand was beating in time with the blows from the bedroom. And at that she looked up at Camilla's face. Her sister's eyes were glowing with excitement, and the eeriest thing was, Camilla looked just like Zala himself, and she was smiling. She was suppressing a smirk. And in that instant, Lisbeth realized that Camilla was not only trying to ingratiate herself with her father, she was also right behind his violence. She was cheering him on.
That's sick.
But that's how it was. Do you know what Lisbeth did? She remained perfectly calm. She sat down next to Camilla and took her hand almost tenderly. Perhaps Camilla thought her sister was looking for some comfort or closeness. Stranger things have happened. Elizabeth rolled up her sister's shirt sleeve and dug her fingernails into Camilla's wrist, down to the bone, ripping open a terrible wound. Blood streamed onto the bed. Elizabeth dragged Camilla to the floor and swore she would kill both her and her father if the beatings and the rapes did not stop.
Jesus!
You can imagine the hatred between the sisters. Both Agneta and the social services were so worried that something even more serious would happen, that they were kept apart. For a while, they arranged a home elsewhere for Camilla. Sooner or later, they probably would have clashed again, but in the end, as you know, things did not turn out like that. I believe the sisters only saw each other once after Lisbeth was locked up, several years later, when a disaster was narrowly averted, but I know none of the details. I haven't heard anything of Camilla for a long time now. The last people to have had contact with her of a foster family with whom she lived in Uppsala, people called Dahlgren. I can get you the number. But ever since Camilla was 18 or 19, and she packed a bag and left the country, she hasn't been heard from. That's why I was astonished when you said that you had met her. Not even Lisbeth, with her famous ability to track people down, has been able to find her.
So she has tried.
Oh, yes. As far as I know, the last time was when her father's estate was to be apportioned.
I didn't realize.
Elizabeth mentioned it in passing. She didn't want a single penny from that will. To her it was blood money. But she could tell that there was something strange about it. There were assets of 4 million kronor. The farm in Gossaberga, some securities, a run-down industrial site in Nortelja, a cottage somewhere, and various other bits and pieces. Not insignificant by any means, and yet...
He should have been worth much more.
Yes, Elizabeth was aware that he ran a vast criminal empire. 4 million would have been small change in that context.
So you're saying she wondered if Camilla inherited the lion's share?
I think that's what she's been trying to find out. The mere thought that her father's fortune was going on doing harm after his death was torture to her. But for a long time she got nowhere.
Camilla concealed her identity well.
I assume so.
Do you have any reason to think Camilla might have taken over her father's trafficking business?
Maybe, maybe not. She may have struck out into something altogether different.
Such as? Palmgren closed his eyes and took a large sip of his brandy.
I can't be sure of this, Mikko. But when you told me about Professor Balder, I had a thought. Do you have any idea why Lisbeth is so good with computers? Do you know how it all started?
I have no idea.
Then I'll tell you. I wonder if the key to your story doesn't lie there.
When Salander came in from the terrace and saw August huddled in a stiff and unnatural position by the round table, she realized that the boy reminded her of herself as a child. That is exactly how she had felt at Lundegarten, until one day it became clear to her that she had to grow up far too soon, to take revenge on her father. It was a burden no child should have to bear. But it had been the beginning of a real life, a more dignified life. No bastard should be allowed to do what Zarechenko or Balder's murderer had done with impunity. She went to August and said solemnly, as if giving an important order,
"You're going to go to bed now. When you wake up, I want you to do the drawing that will nail your father's killer. Do you get that?"
The boy nodded and shuffled into his bedroom, while Salander opened her laptop and started to look for information about Lasse Westman and his circle of friends.
"I don't think Zarechenko himself was much use with computers," Palmgren said. "He wasn't of that generation. But perhaps his dirty business grew to such a scale that he had to use a computer program to keep his accounts and to keep them away from his accomplices. One day he came to Lundegarten with an IBM machine which he installed on the desk next to the window. Nobody in the family had seen a computer before. Zarechenko promised that if anyone so much as touched the machine, he would flay them alive. From a purely psychological point of view, that was telling. It increased the temptation."
"Forbidden fruit."
"Elizabeth was around 11 at the time. It was before she tore into Camilla's right arm and before she went for her father with knives and petrol bombs. You could say it was just before she became the Elizabeth we know today. She lacked stimulation. She had no friends to speak of, partly because Camilla had made sure that nobody came anywhere near her at school, but partly because she was different. I don't know if she realized it herself yet. Her teachers and those around her didn't. But she was an extremely gifted child. Her talent alone set her apart. School was deadly boring for her. Everything was obvious and easy. She needed only to take a quick look at things to understand them, and during lessons she sat there daydreaming. I do believe, however, that by then she had managed to find some things in her free time which interested her. Advanced maths books, that sort of thing. But basically she was bored stiff. She spent a lot of time reading her Marvel comics, which were way below her intellectual level, but perhaps fulfilled another therapeutic function."
"In what sense?"
"To be honest, I'm reluctant to try to play the shrink with Lisbeth. She would hate it if she could hear me. But those comics are full of superheroes fighting against supervillains, taking matters into their own hands to exact revenge and see to it that justice is done. For all I know, that may have been the perfect sort of reading material. Perhaps those stories, with their black-and-white view of the world, helped her to gain some clarity."
"You mean she understood she had to grow up and become a superhero herself?"
"In some way, maybe, in her own little world. At the time she didn't know that Zarechenko had been a Soviet spy, and that his secrets had given him a unique position in Swedish society.
She wouldn't have had any idea either that there was a special section within Seppo which protected him. But like Camilla, she sensed that her father had some sort of immunity. One day a man in a grey overcoat appeared at the apartment and hinted that their father must come to no harm. Elizabeth realized early on that there was no point in reporting Zalichenko to the police or the social services. That would only result in yet another man in a grey overcoat turning up on their doorstep. Powerlessness, Mikhail, can be a devastating force. And before Elizabeth was old enough to do something about it, she needed a place of strength, a refuge. She found that in the world of superheroes. I know better than most how important literature can be, whether it's comic books or fine old novels, and I know that Elizabeth grew particularly attached to a young heroine called Janet Van Dyne.
Van Dyne?
That's right, a girl whose father was a rich scientist. The father is murdered by aliens, if I remember right, and in order to take revenge, Janet Van Dyne gets in touch with one of her father's old colleagues, and in his laboratory acquires superpowers. She becomes the Wasp, someone you can't push around, either literally or figuratively.
I didn't know that.
So that's where she gets her handle from? Not just the handle. I knew nothing about all that sort of stuff. I was an old dinosaur who got the Phantom mixed up with Mandrake the Magician. But the first time I saw a picture of the Wasp, it gave me a start. There was so much of Elizabeth in her. There still is, in a way. I think she picked up a lot of her style from that character. I don't want to make too much of it, but I do know she thought a great deal about the transformation Janet Van Dyne underwent when she became the Wasp. Somehow, she understood that she herself had to undergo the same drastic metamorphosis, from child and victim to someone who could fight back against a highly trained and ruthless intelligence agent. Thoughts like these occupied her day and night, and so the Wasp became an important figure for her during her period of transition, a source of inspiration, and Camilla found out about it. That girl had an uncanny ability to nose out other people's weaknesses. She used her tentacles to feel for their sensitive points and would then strike exactly there. So she came to make fun of the Wasp, in whichever way she could. She even found out who Wasp's Marvel enemies were, and began to call herself by their names, Thanos and all the others.
"Did you say Thanos?"
said Blomqvist, suddenly alert. "I think that's what he was called, a destroyer who once fell in love with Death itself. Death had appeared to him in the shape of a woman, and after that he wanted to prove himself worthy of her, or something like that. Camilla became a fan of his, so as to provoke Elizabeth. She even called her gang of friends the Spider Society, in one of the comics that group are the sworn enemies of the Sisterhood of the Wasp."
"Really?"
Blomqvist said, his mind racing. "Yes, I suppose it was childish, but that didn't make it innocent. There was such hostility between the sisters, even then, that those names took on a nasty significance."
"Do you think that's still relevant?"
"The names, you mean?"
"Yes, I suppose so."
Blomqvist was not sure what he meant, but he had a vague feeling that he had lit upon something important.
"I don't know,"
Palmgren said. "They're grown women now, but we mustn't forget that those were decisive times in their lives. Looking back, it's perfectly possible that small details could turn out to be of fateful significance. It wasn't just that Elizabeth lost a mother and was then locked up. Camilla's existence, too, was smashed to pieces. She lost her home, and the father she admired suffered severe burns. As you know, after the petrol bomb, Zalichenko was never himself again. Camilla was put in a foster home, miles from the world whose undisputed leading light she had been. It must have been bitterly hurtful for her, too. I don't doubt for one second that she's hated Elizabeth with a murderous fury ever since."
"It certainly looks like it," Blomqvist said.
Palmgren took another sip of brandy.
"The sisters were in a state of out-and-out war during this period, and somehow I think they both knew that everything was about to blow up. I think they were even preparing for it."
"But in different ways."
"Oh, yes. Elizabeth had a brilliant mind, and infernal plans and strategies were constantly ticking away in her head. But she was alone. Camilla was not so bright, not in the conventional sense. She never had a head for studies, and was incapable of understanding abstract reasoning. But she knew how to manipulate people to do her bidding. So, unlike Elizabeth, she was never alone.
If Camilla discovered that Lisbeth was good at something which could be a threat to her, she never tried to acquire the same skill, for the simple reason she knew she couldn't compete with her sister.
So what did she do instead?
Instead, she would track down somebody, or better still, more than one person, who could do